Il-program li ser tisimaw huwa miġjub lilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
Welcome to University Matters on Campus FM. This is Patricia Camilleri, inviting you to discover what research, projects and events are taking place at the University of Malta. I'm very pleased to have with me in the studio today for University Matters, Dr. Jean Kalea Ajous. Just the usual word that I say about my guests, Dr. Kalea Ajous graduated MD here at the University of Malta. She further specialised in obstetrics and gynaecology, both locally and at University College London Hospital. She obtained her memberships of the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists and of the Royal College of Physicians of Ireland on her first attempt, I might say, in 2005. And for who has tried to get those qualification or memberships, they know how difficult that is. From an early stage in her career, Dr. Kalea Ajous showed a keen interest in research and teaching on all aspects of reproductive sciences. She was appointed an assistant lecturer in 2000 here at the university, and since then has been teaching medical students, postgraduate trainees and other health professionals. She is an instructor in advanced life support in obstetrics from the UK and organised the first ALSO, because that's the acronym, course in Malta in July 2011 for training obstetricians and midwives. She also organises the Royal College of Obstetricians Part 1 Basic Science course for junior doctors at the Mater Dei Hospital. She has numerous, of course, peer-reviewed research articles published in international high-impact journals, and she obtained her PhD at University College London in February 2012. The title of her thesis is The Role of the Pro and Anti-Inflammatory Cytokines in Early Pregnancy. I hope I pronounced that correctly. Her research involves investigations of the association between systemic and placental cytokines and miscarriages in human pregnancy. The current research interests of Dr. Kalea Ajous are recurrent miscarriages and infertility. Amongst her many prizes, she has obtained the Best Oral Presentation Prize at the Maltese Medical School Conference and also the Green Armitage Travel Bursary and several others. Welcome to the programme, Dr. Kalea Ajous.
Thank you for your invitation.
Today we are continuing our discussion with various academics from different faculties about their COST, European Cooperation in Science and Technology projects. And with you today, Dr. Kalea Ajous, we shall be talking in fact about two: the European Network for Human Congenital Imprinting Disorders and another one called ENTIRE, another of those acronyms for European Network for Translational Immunology Research and Education. Let's start with the European Network for Human Congenital Imprinting. Of course, my first question will have to be, what are imprinting disorders?
Okay. So basically, they're a type of genetic problem which can be inherited from one of the parents, or the parents themselves might just be carriers. They might not have the actual condition themselves, but like a mutation, like a defect happens in their genetic component. And when the egg is fertilized, I mean, from a mother or from the father who might be carrying this genetic problem, the imprinting, so the translation of the maternal genetic component or the paternal genetic component into the baby, into the embryo, something goes wrong there. And they tend to be associated with what we call overgrowth symptoms or overgrowth syndromes. There are a number of these syndromes.
Not very many. I was looking on the website and having not very many.
And actually, as time goes along, they are sort of discovering that certain conditions are actually coming from imprinting. So, I mean, in total, definite that they're known even in the medical books, and sort of they're well studied. There are about 6 or 7. And the most famous of these, there's a certain one called Beckwith-Fiedermann syndrome, which is associated with overgrowth. So these babies, they would be quite big in size, and there would be associated usually mental problems, mental retardation problems. But there are others, and there's another one called Engelmann syndrome. Basically, what's interesting, for example, that the Beckwith-Fiedermann and the Engelmann syndrome, Engelmann syndrome again, very similar, and also associated with hypotonia, so there is lack of tone in the muscles of the baby. Both of them, actually, when you look at the baby's karyotype, so the baby's genetic component, it would be the same. So they would have the same genetic problem, the same genetic defect. But it's an imprinting disorder, because in Beckwith-Wiedermann, they would have inherited the problem from the father, while in Engelmann syndrome, they would have inherited the problem from the mother. So although it's the same gene which goes haywire, but because it is inherited from the mother or the father, it will translate into a different problem. Okay, so those are the two most famous ones. There are others. The most recent in the category, there is a certain one called Temple syndrome, and basically it's named after a certain Karen Temple, who is a professor of genetics in Southampton. And basically she has observed, in her genetics clinic, a number of babies, a number of children and adults coming through with certain patterns. And when studied, it was found that it's an imprinting problem. Okay, so it is a kind of a genetic problem. Now, recently, there is a lot of interest in it. Apart from it being a rare disease and people want to know more about these and so on. And especially people who might have been classified as having, let's say, autistic problem or learning difficulty. It turns out that their problem is genetic, and obviously that will have implications on when they are themselves thinking of having their own family. Apart from that, over the last 30 years or so, obviously there has been the introduction of IVF, of in vitro fertilization. And what has now been confirmed is that certain media, certain substances that are used in the process, which obviously has done a lot of good and has been the biggest breakthrough in science, in my opinion, in recent years, there is an association with certain media, which are media meaning where the egg and the sperm, where they are put so that they meet and they fertilize. There is some association, there is an association between certain types of media that have been used and the potential problems of imprinting disorders in the embryo resulting from that IVF process. Obviously, they are still rare. It's not the norm. I don't want people who are hearing us and they're,
worrying. They start unnecessarily.
But considering that it is a rare condition, there has been this association made. So now, obviously, people are looking into that and studying that into more detail. So, and that's where I come in.
And these defects, these IDs, have they been, have we known about them for some time? Is it something new?
Well, they have been described. For example, this Beckwith-Fiedermann syndrome has been described around the turn of the century. So it wasn't identified as a proper imprinting disorder, like the term imprinting is quite a recent term. But the association of the syndrome, so for example certain features, certain things which point to that particular condition, they have been described. So Beckwith and Wiedermann, they were actually two different doctors who in their own right, in their own clinics, they have described them. So they have been known, but then the actual, like, hitting the nail on the head and knowing that it is an imprinting disorder, no, that's a relatively recent term, so over the last 50 years or so. And as the more we learn about them, as we speak, the more number of syndromes are coming into that class. It's a bit difficult to, it's a bit slower to come to the conclusion that it would be an imprinted disorder, because you have to study generations. And then, for example, if you're seeing an adult, if his parents are still alive, you can check their blood sample and their karyotype. But if the grandparents of that adult are diseased, you can't check them. So in neonates, it's easier, because usually the parents would still be alive, and obviously the grandparents, and even the great-grandparents. And again, you have also to take in consideration that I mean, even Malta, but especially abroad, people move around. So you might have the child and their parents living in a country, the grandparents living somewhere else.
I was going to ask, are these imprinting disorders mm-hmm. across the board, worldwide?
They are worldwide, yes, they are worldwide. And that applies for most genetic problems. So there are no ethnic differences, really. So, and again, I mean, this type of syndrome, I mean, in the affluent countries, like developed countries, they would be flagged up. In non-affluent countries, I mean, at the moment, coincidentally, I've received an email from a colleague of mine who's working in Tanzania, and a certain Dr. Maria Borda, and she's an obstetrician, and she has this obstetric hospital in Tanzania. Sadly, I mean, very recently, she delivered a baby, and there was an unusual death, so the baby died within a few hours of that. And she did notice that this baby was what we call dysmorphic, so there were certain features, and he didn't look normal. But, unfortunately, in her hospital, there was no access to doing karyotyping, which is a relatively, not a simple test, but, I mean, it is available, it's done, it's even done at Mater Dei. But, I mean, she couldn't do it. The closest hospital which could do it was about 4 hours drive away. And this is a fresh sample of blood in Tanzania. So even to take it to that hospital. Mm-hmm. So these conditions are everywhere. And probably from what she described about this baby, he did probably have an imprinting disorder. But you can't prove it because...
it's more difficult when
yes,
you have the...
Yes, so the incidence of it... Yes, the incidence of it might be much more than we think, really.
What about the cost action itself? Mm-hmm. I mean, why was the need felt to mm-hmm. create the cost action? Yes. Probably for these reasons.
Yes, exactly.
Would it be this reason?
Yes, it is a rare disease. It's still considered as a rare disease. Now, in certain countries like Germany, and in fact, the lead partner is from Germany, certain Dr. Thomas Egerman from Aachen in Germany. He, in his unit, they do keep a register of rare diseases. And in Malta, I'm aware that it is about to start this register of rare diseases. So in countries, and in fact, there are about 11 countries in this cost section so far. It's all countries where they already have a register or they have a way of diagnosing patients with imprinting disorders. But the whole idea of this cost section is that first of all, they start by doing what we call the genetic cards. The genetic card is, for things like Beckwith-Wiedermann and Dengelmann, which have been known for quite some time now. We know all the features, so you have like a checklist. So for a patient to be diagnosed with Beckwith-Wiedermann, you have to have a number of these features. And then obviously confirmation by doing the karyotype, the blood test. But for others, it's still a bit unclear. So you might have some subtle things which can be look like normal, but you know, if they're part of a collection of symptoms, they're not exactly normal. So they want to start off by defining the clinical features and making what we call these genetic cards. So let's say if I'm a geneticist working on my own somewhere around the world, I mean, I can, you know, have this like checklist, and if this patient has the features on the checklist, then I can make a proper diagnosis.
So standardization,
exactly, that's the word. That's one of the main working group packages. That's probably the biggest, the core of it. Also, from the molecular point of view, these imprinting disorders, it's not the standard genetic test that you would do, for example, for diagnosing something more straightforward like trisomy 21, which is Down syndrome. That is quite simple to diagnose from a genetic test. But imprinting disorders, it's not just a matter of seeing the genetic defect, which sometimes can be quite subtle. You have to check whether it has been expressed or not. So not only is there the gene, but is it like switched on or off? Okay, and also whether it is maternally inherited or paternally inherited, because that will affect the way it's expressed. So it's even more complicated, so even from the molecular point of view. So another work package is defining the best techniques on how to do the interpretation of the test and how to do the test. Because again, people around the world in their own clinics might do it differently, and that will affect your result, and obviously not only the result and what you tell the patient, but his implications on his offspring, on whether he would start a family or not. Mm-hmm. These complications have limited the research on imprinting disorders. At the same time, hopefully from this network, people will pull in their knowledge, their ideas, standardize things both in the lab and in the clinic, and obviously that will help patients. There is also the involvement, one of the partners is a patient support group, again from Germany so far, because these people, I mean, you know, if you look up on the internet something which is kind of commoner, again, like Down syndrome, trisomy 21, you find a lot of information, a lot of support groups. But on imprinting disorders, I mean, even the patients find it hard to understand. I mean, even doctors find it hard to understand what it's about, let alone patients. So having a support group, an international support group, that is actually one also of the aims of the of this
that
network.
Like a terribly good idea in the in the context. With me today on Campus FM for University Matters is Dr. Jean Kalea-Ajous, and she's telling us about the cost research projects that she's involved in. I know that the cost doesn't actually give money for the research itself, but it gives money for the networking and the meetings and that sort of thing.
Yes.
I know that this particular cost project has not been long up and running.
No, only
have you managed to...
Well, so far there has been the kickoff meeting was sometime just before summer of 2013, so less than a year ago. And this was the kickoff meeting. And at the time, I mean, there were 11 partners, so 11 countries, and the main aim was to try to invite other countries, to get more more numbers, even numbers of patients and more information. Then, following that, there was the first working group meeting in Aachen, that's obviously where the lead partner is. That was in October, and there everyone sort of was kind of assigned which working group, for example, the Maltese participants, there's me and there's Dr. Edith Said, who is a consultant geneticist at Mater Dei. We were more involved in the clinical part rather than in the scientific part, where it comes to describing features, etc., and also having involved in dissemination. So that is writing papers, also papers not just in the high-impact scientific journals, which only a relatively few number of people read, but even in the nursing journals, in the midwifery journals, who are midwives and nurses really, and neonatal nurses working in the neonatal intensive care unit, they would be the patients spending, the people spending more time with the baby, with the neonate, and observing certain features, rather than maybe, you know, a scientist or the pediatrician who might only be seeing the baby for a short time.
So everyone has something to contribute.
Exactly, and these features, I mean, a lot of them, they're not like something, you know, that you see, but something that you have to observe. So again, even the same parents, they need to know a bit more about it, what to look out for. So that's the involvement of the support group.
As a researcher, I can imagine that you get a lot out of a project like this. How do you feel? You feel pleased about the progress, and you feel you're going to get something from it?
Yes, I mean, especially this. I mean, when you know that it is going to be translated into clinical and it's going to have an impact on a patient's life, especially if it is a baby, you know, that is going to have effect on his family and everyone who is related to that person. So it's not just something in the lab or something to get a patent out over it and make money. Not that, but you actually have an impact. And although this is like the beginning, but I know that this will have an impact even on what we teach medical students, on how to diagnose, what to teach nurses and doctors. Yeah. So, no, this is a great
one. Commission's money, Europe's money well spent.
Exactly.
Moving on to the second cost action that you were involved with, this is something that came in towards the end of the project, isn't it?
Yes, I did. As you rightly said in the beginning, I got my PhD in 2012. And after then, I was very focused on writing up and submitting and the Viva and so on. So I honestly didn't, I mean, I just had heard of a course, of course, but you know, it was far
away.
Exactly. So when I got to, you know, look up into cost and how to start networking and so on, I came across this, and there was a doctor, now Professor Janet Mifsud, who introduced me to cost. And this particular action, the entire, was in its last year. And but given that my research is more on reproductive immunology, which is like immunology, so that comes into miscarriages, infertility, preeclampsia, which is high blood pressure in pregnancy, preterm. So immunology, there's a lot of, most of the advances which are being done in reproductive medicine are based on immunology, and cancer, obviously, gynecological cancers and other cancers. And basically said, okay, might as well we apply and we see if the rest of the consortium are interested. I mean, if not, I mean, it's not a big deal because it's about to end. But we actually wrote to them and we got a reply immediately. They were actually on the lookout for someone on reproductive immunology. And so in a way, I came in, I guess, at the right time. And I've already gone to one meeting for these. Immediately on the first meeting, they were talking of this conference and training school to end the project. And they allocated a whole expert session on reproductive immunology. So it was, yes, a great way of, how to say, expose the research that I've done, and at the same time also to disseminate and tie in with the rest of their immunology research.
You mentioned what you sort of do in your immunology research. Mm-hmm. Can you sort of pinpoint one or two things which were particular parts of your research that are
in my case? Yes, basically what I've looked at were women who have miscarriages. So whether it's a recurrent miscarriage, meaning that they have three miscarriages in a row, or this is their first miscarriage, and trying to look into why it happens, okay? And if you can predict it, what does it mean? Because usually when there is a miscarriage, the first sign is that the lady, who's the pregnant lady, sees some bleeding. Now, if she sees some bleeding and you do an ultrasound and the baby's heart is there, so the baby is still alive and the baby is still, the pregnancy is still ongoing, but she's bleeding at that stage, I mean, unfortunately, I mean, what the standard practice is that you tell them, okay, we have to wait and see, and I'll see you in 2 weeks' time, and then we'll see what happens. And obviously, first question is, the patient, can I do anything? Can it prevent, it be prevented, etc. So my role was that those women who come in with bleeding and the pregnancy is still ongoing, and at that stage, so they have a 50% chance of miscarrying, 50% chance of the pregnancy continuing, to try to determine at that stage if there is a way of detecting those who are going to miscarry, those who aren't, and those who aren't going to miscarry, or even those who will miscarry a normal pregnancy, because remember, there are about 50% of miscarriages unfortunately happen because there would be a problem with this pregnancy, like a chromosomal problem. But the other 50%, they miscarry a normal baby. So it's those ones that you want to give them something or help them in a way so their pregnancy continues. And usually the recurrent miscarriers are fall in that category as well. So you're every time losing a normal pregnancy, to try to detect it. And basically, one of the results of my research was, yes, that there is a blood test which can be done, which helps to predict them. There are these cytokines, basically, these cytokines, there are a whole group of them, they're like hormones, but they're not exactly hormones, they're like special hormones which are involved in inflammation. And if there is a particular ratio in these hormones, you can actually predict whether that lady is going to miscarry or not. And it has been published also in the American Journal, it has been patented, and there are now other groups working on actually applying it. So hopefully in the future there will be a test which will be used in the clinic. So yes, that's one of the work that I did.
it's always interesting to hear somebody who's been talking or doing a PhD, which has taken over their lives for, I mean, they've been doing it part-time at least 5 years.
Yes, it is part-time. Yes.
And then, you know, one hopes that the work that's been done, especially something like this, will actually come to fruition.
Yes.
And that is done through, as you say, publishing in journals.
Yes. And in fact, I mean, yes, another, how can I say, it was a big ego boost, put it this way, very recently in November I've been invited at this ESHRE conference. It's ESHRE is the European Society for Human Reproduction and Biology. It is quite a big thing in the field of obstetrics and gynecology, and if you want to know the latest, that's where kind of you go. And I've been invited to give a presentation on my talk, and there's a certain professor from the University of Chicago. She actually came up and she told me, and I have a freezer full of blood and I want you to test it, because these are things which say, okay, so what I'm saying from Little Malta, it's actually impacting medicine. So
absolutely,
yes,
wonderful. Yes. I know that you mentioned before we went on air that there's going to be an important meeting
in Malta.
I think it's April, you said.
Exactly,
tell us something about that.
Basically, that brings us back to the cost. So cost, one section of cost is the biomedical research. So that's why all these cost sections that are involved, they all start with a BM and then they have a number, so it's biomedical. And the lead partners of all these biomedical, all these cost sections related to biomedical, they're going to have this meeting on the 28th, 29th April in Malta, and where basically they have to present to the cost office and to all of Europe, put it this way, what they've been doing. So if the money which was allocated to them for the cost section, if it is
has been well spent.
And there are many ways, obviously, that can be used, but apart from disseminating and affecting clinical practice or the scientific world, the other aim is actually trying to look at Horizon 2020. So Horizon 2020 is this funding program from the EU, which is similar to the FP7, which was FP7, FP6, and now it's called Horizon 2020. And the idea of most of these courses is to eventually create a good network which can apply for a good project for more funding. So obviously research, it has to be ongoing, and even, let's say, what we're saying about the imprinting disorders, things change, science advances, so it's not just you write a set of things and those guidelines keep on applying.
Yes, and
it has to be reviewed.
And who's organizing this meeting?
Yes, being organized by Professor Janet Mifsud, and there's also Professor Giuseppe De Giovanni who's involved, and anyone who locally is involved in a cost action is trying to put this all together.
Unfortunately, we've come to the end of our time. Thank you very, very much, Dr. Jean Calais Ajous, for coming to talk to us
about
interesting projects today.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to University Matters on Campus FM. I hope you'll join us again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.
Il-program li għadkom kem smajtu kien miġju plilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.